I was having some like huevos rancheros, homemade.
Ooh. Ooh.
And I went a bit heavy in the cayenne, so...
How multicultural of you.
Cayenne Jackson. Thank you.
Jackson, get out of here with that.
What do you mean? That was funny. Is it cayenne? Is it cayenne? Cayenne?
I thought... isn't it Cheyenne?
No, I know it's Cheyenne, but how do you say the name of the pepper?
I mean, we in our American accents, we'd probably say cayenne pepper, but I...
So it's a bit... yeah. It's probably cayenne.
It probably is.
Cayenne's
who knows?
Funnier. Because I can make
this is why we're not a food podcast.
I know. That's the one like alternate podcast we'll never be able to do is food.
I do have one of these days. I have a musical theater cookbook. When the video ideas dull down, we might delve into that musical theater cookbook.
You're going to bring out your inner Julia Child.
And it's like, you know, My Fair Lady mashed potatoes. Like, it's just...
delicious. With bits of, like, grit in it.
Yeah, exactly.
From the streets.
Will somebody get us another drink?
Welcome to Jim and Tomic's Musical Theater Happy Hour, your weekly podcast with Playbills and Perrier.
How swanky.
I know, right? We are the epitome. We are the most swankified place in town.
We are. Da 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 da. I think that was the tune.
That was close enough. I believe you.
What's crossing your lips today?
Today I am drinking champagne, not ginger ale.
I was literally going to say... I don't know. What can I be drinking? I'm drinking many different herrings. And just like blended up with some ice.
That sounds literally like the most disgusting thing I've ever
heard.
The
new fad diet. You'll get into it. It's yeah.
Blended herring.
Yeah, exactly. Delicious. Okay, what the hell are we talking about? Well, the musical that we're going to be talking about this week, Tommy, is immensely funny from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
What a statement. But many of its funniest moments developed from actor ad-libs and stage mishaps. What a caper. From accidentally throwing a coat across stage onto a coat rack and getting a standing ovation to being trapped on stage because of a malfunctioning door. Oh my goodness, what a disaster. What musical?
I like your quiz question commentary.
Thank you.
2001 A Space Odyssey. No, not that. Mystery Science Theater.
2001 A Space Odyssey.
I get those two confused in a bizarre crisscross in my mind.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. Stanley Kubrick could have done Mystery Science Theater.
He basically did. What musical are we talking about, Jimmy?
We're talking about The Producers.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer, lunch at Sardi's every day. I want to be a producer, sport a top hat and a cane. I want to be a producer and drive those chorus girls insane.
Loads of people say wicked.
Yeah, interesting.
It must be because of it's like the apocryphal trapdoor story.
Yeah, I wonder if it's more like, it just seems like a law of averages. There are so many productions of Wicked and it has been playing for so long that you're more likely to encounter onstage mishaps.
Nobody throws a coat across the stage onto a coat rack in Wicked.
Not in the Wicked you've seen.
That's true. Yeah, we have it different in the West End.
No, but so apparently when... Max and Leo meet for the first time, and Max says to Leo, like, oh, you may I take your coat? And he's like, yes, and he hands him his coat, and he goes, so you're an accountant? And Matthew Broderick goes, yes, I am. And Nathan Lane goes, so account for yourself, and throws the coat over his shoulder, and it flies across the stage and lands squarely on the coat rack to a standing ovation from the crowd.
Yeah, as you would do. It seems like that scene, like their first scene, and we'll, classic podcast drinking moment, we'll go into this in a bit. It seems like that scene is like... the most ad-lib scene in the whole of theater.
I think it is one of the funniest pieces of comedy that has
really
ever been
created,
is that entire intro scene. But so, The Producers, music and lyrics by Mel Brooks, and book by Mel Brooks and Thomas Meehan. Did you know this? I only learned this. Brooks wanted Jerry Herman to work on this musical with him.
Oh, really?
Can you imagine?
Yeah, interesting.
Right? It like I can see it, but it would be a very different show.
It would be. Would it? I wonder if it would be really good.
I think Jerry Herman would get like the camp and the idea of it all. I think based on the stuff he writes, I imagine he would shy away from some of the grittier, more offensive.
Never going to let that slide.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I wonder if like that would be a weird match made in heaven.
Yeah, and who knows? The quote I read was Jerry Herman told Mel Brooks, "Well, you should just write it because you write good songs yourself." And so I wonder who, you know, makes it seem like Jerry was like, "Oh no, I don't need to write this with you. You're great.
You'll be fine. Good luck." And then, oh, you know.
Right.
It kind of worked. Yeah. It's based on Mel Brooks' original movie from the 60s, starring Gene Wilder and Zero Mostel.
Fabulous.
Kind of a cult
movie.
Classic.
Yeah, I would say more than a cult classic. It's the second highest rated comedy on Rotten Tomatoes below The Wizard of Oz.
Below The Wizard of Oz?
Well, because The Wizard of Oz is a comedy-ish and has a high rating, but...
Yeah, fascinating.
It's up there. It's a popular movie.
Okay, well, there you go. And yeah, Mel Brooks is the master of
comedy.
Comedy.
Of dark, offensive, low-level comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
So this musical version opened on Broadway in 2001 with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick and ran for 2,500 performances.
Yeah.
Ran for several years.
Yeah, it did pretty darn well.
Yeah.
And over my neck of the woods, it opened up with Nathan Lane again. And Lee Evans, who you'll probably have no idea who he is.
Nope, never heard of
Lee Evans. I think we've spoken about him before. Do you know that?
Yeah, but I never listened to you, so, you know.
He was in an episode of Doctor Who, and I remember telling you about that. Do you remember the Easter episode?
No.
It was the one where they drive the bus into the desert. Like, it goes through, like, a time loop, and it goes into the desert.
Oh, that's one of the movies. I've never watched that one.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you should. It was very good. Some great acting.
He looks familiar. He looks like someone who could play Leo.
Yeah, he's a British stand-up comic. He's very slapsticky, like old school Marx Brothers-y style. And very, very talented. So it was the two of them. Obviously not the whole way, but the show ran for 3 years over here too. So,
and then famously, this show was a mega hit at the Tony Awards. It was nominated for 15 awards and won 12. It swept. It won every award it could.
Yep. And it currently holds the record so far.
I mean,
maybe Comet will match it.
It is impossible to beat this record unless they invent a new Tony's category.
Yeah.
For musical theater. So.
Exactly.
It's pretty stunning. And that
what if they bring back sound?
They brought back sound. But sound also existed when the producers ran.
But as in, they don't have sound at the moment.
Yeah, they do.
No, they don't. It's not back yet. It's back next season.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, then who knows?
Who knows?
Do you know I run a musical theater YouTube channel? It's deceptive. People don't believe me when I tell them that.
That's okay. I wondered that as well, but no. So there's the special honor...
Mm-hmm.
This year, because they're bringing it back.
That's what it is. Because of they're giving it to The Encounter.
The Encounter, So yeah, who knows? But either way, it's bloody great. And I think it was Hamilton beat it last year.
Yeah, in nominations,
16 nominations.
Yeah,
well done, Hamilton. You bested us again. So the producers, I find it surprising if people have never even seen it.
Yeah, or in any of its incarnations, because then it also became it took the Hairspray route from straight movie to stage musical to movie musical.
Yep, exactly,
and there's now
the Hairspray route.
A movie musical version of it, too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the producers, it's the story of Max Bialystock, shady Broadway producer in the late 50s.
Yeah.
Who, you know, is suffering from a string of flop musicals that is absolutely bankrupting him, and he doesn't know what to do. And he meets cowardly accountant Leo Bloom, who's there to do his books. And Leo Bloom has the inkling of an idea that you could make more money with a flop musical than with a hit musical. And they run with it.
They do. So the idea is that, accountants never audit failed shows.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll never see where the money goes. So they plan through Max Bialystock's League of Old Ladies, rich old ladies, who he touches and kisses and...
I believe the word is stoops.
Stoops.
Yeah. There you go.
Interesting.
Don't say that in polite company.
Stoop.
Yeah, there you go.
Do I need to edit that out of the podcast?
Only if we have any... No.
Okay, cool. Stoop away.
You're going to get in trouble.
Hey. So he apparently stoops these old ladies for $2 million... dollars,
mm-hmm.
One for me, one for you.
Yep.
And
then the continuation of the plan is to like put on the worst possible Broadway show that is guaranteed to flop.
To flop, yeah. So they hire the worst director in town. They find the worst show.
Mm-hmm.
They cast hopefully the worst actors, and they go on to make a smash hit.
Yeah, unexpectedly. Oh, no. Their musical Springtime for Hitler is far more successful than they want.
Exactly. And so they end up going to prison and try and write a musical there.
Yep. And live happily ever after, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So that's that.
Yeah.
That's it. Done. That's the podcast.
End of. Thank you. We'll see you next week.
No, what were you going to say?
I don't know.
Okay, cool.
I lost it.
Okay, cool. And there's like other, you know, there's a peppering of a love story in there. And,
yeah.
Many, many capers to be had. But,
neo-Nazis, caricatures of gay men.
Yeah, caricatures of everything.
Yeah.
Basically.
Old ladies, tap dance.
Germans.
John Barrowman.
Who knew? So apparently he had just... Like, as the movie was released, he had just done The Empty Child, which means Jack Harkness was, like, just created.
Really?
That's and hilarious. I feel like that's the thing that blasted John Barrowman, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
That's why everyone... Like, we know him a wee bit more.
Uh-huh.
Do you know he was in Hey, Mr. Producer?
Really?
The thing that I talk about every 5 minutes? Yeah, he sings The Fix, which is the one that's like,
yeah.
1, 2, 3, that's how I feel about the future.
Yeah.
And he's quite sexy, and I was like, I find you alluring, young child. So, yep.
Yeah. So the producers, I would say that Mel Brooks trades very much in what he calls lower than low comedy. And very well done, but he, you know, it's offensive. It is offensive.
Yeah.
Especially the original movie. But like done in that comedic way where you're like, this is offensive and I'm laughing and I don't understand.
Yeah. It's pure satire. You know what I mean? It really, really taps into that lovely fine line.
Yeah.
That many have tried to replicate since. But
yeah.
I feel like he does it so well because with producers, I think more than your Avenue Q's and your Mormons,
mm-hmm.
you don't necessarily see it.
Yeah.
Do you know what
I mean? Well, and what I find so fascinating, like a lot of Mel Brooks's other works are very similar to Springtime for Hitler. Like, are, you know, so offensive that they're funny.
Yeah, well, like Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Case in point.
Blazing Saddles.
You know what I mean? And especially now, like, I don't know, is it especially nowadays? Are we more mean to it? Would it have been more shocking back then?
I don't know. I mean, it's shocking.
I don't know.
All
I can't
around.
Tell. It's just perpetually shocking.
Yeah. But so then it becomes this kind of like, because it's a show business show, it's this kind of meta analysis of the Mel Brooks style of this super offensive piece and how funny it becomes with just a couple tweaks here and there.
Exactly.
Which is of course why it does so well. It's because like he understands that so deeply.
Yeah, write what you know, as they say.
Yeah.
Well, perfect time to get in and chat a little bit about the movie.
Woo.
I used to be the king of all Broadway. There'll be gala opening nights again.
You'll see my name in lights again. I'll go from dark to brights again. My spirit's high as kites again. I'll never suffer slights again. I'll taste those sweet delights again. No plethora of blights again. No blossoming of blights again. No frantic fits or frights again. Fame is in my sights again. I'll take those fancy flights again. I'm gonna scale the heights again. Bialystok will never drop. Bialystok will never stop. Bialystok will be on top again.
La movie. What's the French for film?
I believe it's baguette.
Baguette, oui.
You've
listened to Amelie. You should know, because it's so French, right?
Oh God, we won't go into that.
Let us make a vow to never do Amelie.
That's a topic for another podcast.
It's not. I don't want to do it ever.
So the original producer's film came out in 1968, and it's contemporaneously set. So it's set in 1968 as well.
Yep.
Which is one of the primary differences, I think, between the film and the musical, is they backdate the musical to like 1959-ish.
Yeah, it's like early golden age.
Like a good decade before, which actually seems more appropriate for musical theater making time.
Yeah.
But less appropriate for a producer being down on his luck. But I also don't think the audience going into the producer is like, well, wait a minute, what, in 1959, musicals were doing great. How could he be? Like, no one cares.
Yeah. Some people just failed. And I mean, in terms of the actual story, for the most part, it is very similar.
It's very similar. And there are some scenes taken, you know, whole cloth from the movie.
Yeah.
And just plot, like the whole, that scene we were talking about with the intro scene with Max and Leo is like word for word, line for line, straight out of the movie.
Yep. And it is that kind of thing of like, why change gold?
Yeah.
Because it is gold. And like, it feels like a Noel Coward, like, play, do you know what I mean? Like a standard comic play.
It is a farce. It is such a funny introduction to these characters.
Yeah.
And it sets you up that this world is bizarre and weird and above the normal, which you need for this kind of show, because if you take this show too seriously, it's not funny.
Absolutely. I mean, so I saw the film when I was really young, like, and we're talking like 8 years old or something here.
Oh God.
Yeah, I know. Like, not in the sense it was like, oh, inappropriate, you shouldn't be watching that, but just I never really got it. And the main thing I got from it was, I feel so uncomfortable because this is just odd. Like, why are people screaming? Why is this gay man, you know, why has this man got a flower in his shirt? Like, all of these things. It just felt very, very odd. And I think, though, because I obviously watched it again recently for this, and I still had the same kind of feeling, though.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It has that 60s... that thing. I don't know what this thing is. We've talked about this a lot now.
But the 60s thing. Yeah. This like 60s early 70s thing. Yeah. I mean, certainly in this show, very primarily, it has a lot to do with Lorenzo Saint Dubois. Who pretty much the only character that didn't survive to the musical.
Yeah, pretty much. And I'm so sad about it.
Oh, I think it's fine.
No, I love it. Because, honestly, like, that's Love Power is the thing that I remember most from the film.
So if people are only familiar with the musical version, which I was for the longest time, instead of having Franz Liebkin play Hitler in Springtime for Hitler, they actually cast this crazy drugged up acid freak whose initials are LSD to play Hitler
and he's a proper like flower child of that era and his Hitler is more of like a sort of a snappy beatnik light style, which you know again is contemporary, so I can understand. Okay,
that would be
have
funny
someone
to audiences in 1968.
Yes,
I think.
But yeah, so if you're setting your play in the early 50s, then
you can't. Flower child be haven't to, been born yet. Yeah, yeah.
Sadly, but that song is so good.
It is a very funny song. Yes,
it's so good. So obviously it'll be in the show notes, and do go and enjoy it, because it's actually. Do you know what? He's a fantastic actor. What's his name? Let's say his name.
I got it right here. Dick Shawn.
Dick Shawn. I bet you he's like huge, and everyone's gonna be like, "You don't know Dick Shawn.
You don't know Dick Shawn. He's been in this and this and this and this." Actually, he looks kind of huge. Yeah, he's been in a million things.
Has he?
It's a mad world. Okay. The Year Without a Santa Claus. He was the voice of Snow Miser. I'm Mr. Snow Miser.
Weirdly,
Mr.
we've
Cold.
Had this discussion before, and you know, right? I haven't seen this.
Yeah, I know, but I can remind you of the discussion we had previously.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. That's weird. Why does that come up again?
All right.
So that's probably one of the main differences.
Yes, and I would say the musical ends and kind of continues on a bit of a happier note. The movie is darker in its creation, in its existence.
Yes, and you don't really get the nice happy payoff at the end of the film.
Yeah. No, these are like bad people who get their comeuppance and you laugh at them.
Exactly.
Whereas in the musical, they become more sympathetic characters that you're rooting for in spite of their deep, deep flaws.
The villainy.
Yeah,
the villainy
exactly.
That exists.
Yeah.
But I find this really interesting, actually, because when I was listening to the musical and then in Keep It Gay, when, you know, Roger's like, you know, a musical should be fun, it should be lighthearted, mm-hmm. it should have a happy ending. And I'm like, oh, yeah. That's quite nice, because it calls back to the way that this musical ends.
Yes.
As opposed to, you know, the dark and sordid film.
I do, so controversial question.
Yeah.
Let's say we're talking the stage Broadway musical versus the original straight movie.
Stage Broadway musical.
As opposed to the movie version of it. So, yes. Just like the 2001 stage musical versus the 1968 movie.
Uh-huh.
Forgetting the order they existed in, which form do you think is a better telling of this story?
The film.
Really?
Yes, because it's more my kind of thing.
Okay. What do you mean?
Well, I like my, you know, Lynchian style weirdness. That 70s thing that we can't hit on.
Yeah, that we can't
I love
nail
that.
Down.
Do you know what I mean?
That's true.
And that, to be honest, as much as there's so much stuff pinched from the film, that tone doesn't actually exist in the musical.
No. Exactly.
And I guess because when you put something on a Broadway stage, it's heightened so much.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Where this a stage play, I think it would have elements of that.
Yeah, I agree.
But you can almost forgive someone like Roger Elizabeth Debrie and Carmen Ghia being the way they are. When it's a musical, because you expect a man to be in a gown when he's singing a song called
And that is why I think my answer would be the opposite. I think this... Right. Pure story fits better as a musical because of exactly that. In the movie, like in the context of the movie, when you enter this, you know, hyper stereotypical satire of a gay man's residence and life, and like you see this whole thing is hilarious, don't get me wrong, but because this is a show about, this is a movie about laughing at the characters, there's something about that like, and it's, you know, this is what Mel Brooks does, but it twists me a little bit. I'm like, you're being funny, and I find it a little offensive because it's, but when it's, you know, when he arrives in a gown to an orchestra underscore and then starts singing and then like starts dancing, it's like, there is no verisimilitude. There is no semblance of suggestion that this is real life. And so I'm like, what a ridiculous thing. Like,
exactly.
It lets me get past it a little more.
Yeah. I would agree with you. I think it makes more sense as a musical.
Okay.
I think me personally, I think I prefer it as a film. But that's because I'm a weirdo. I'm a freak, baby.
We're
I
all
want
weirdos.
Your love and I want your... Did you know it was meant to be a book?
Really?
Yep. His initial idea was to turn it into a book.
That would have been really boring.
Yeah. But basically, he never kind of thought of himself as a writer, as in of like novel. And yeah, so changed it into a film after We Will. And there's quite a lot of discussion. He's never said this, but about the characters.
Okay.
and where they came from.
Yeah.
So basically, I mean, he has said that, you know, Max Bialystock exists.
Like, is based on a producer he once met.
And Leo Bloom exists. And then there was much talk at the time that it was in fact a parody of David Merrick, who produced Hello Dolly.
Mm-hmm.
But his official statement was that, I've got the quote here, so he says that Max and Leo are me, the ego and id of my personality. Bialystock, who's tough, scheming, full of ideas, bluster, ambition, wounded pride, and Leo, this magical child. But I don't doubt that.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's probably literally just bing.
Yeah, the characters are too, like, despite how satirical and comical they are, they're too complex to not be based in some reality.
Yeah, exactly. And it would, you know, maybe not even the bits you'd expect, because he'd say that he'd once worked with a guy who, even though he was well into his 60s, made love with a different little old lady every afternoon on his leather couch in his office. It's dark.
Yeah. It is such a bizarre tangling of, like, really weird character traits.
Yeah.
And, like, passed off as, like, of course this is the way this works. Like, yes.
Absolutely.
I have a bunch, you know, this one's hold me, touch me, you know, bite me, chew me, whatever their names are. Like, and you're like, oh, it's funny. And I, and like that. And yeah, must be real, of course.
Yeah. And he is part werewolf, so there's that. So, yeah, the film is great, and I would definitely recommend watching the film.
Totally. It is a comedic masterpiece.
Absolutely.
Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder, two, like, beautiful comics of the Golden Age.
Absolutely. Did Gene Wilder ever do a music, like a stage musical?
I don't know if he's ever done a stage musical. He certainly was in Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
And I know he had a serious stage acting career. Oh, I don't know. There's an anecdote about how he got on this show, and I don't remember where I read it, but something to do with he was playing a role in a really serious show on stage. I don't know quite where. I want to say it was like Mother Courage or something.
Okay, cool.
And kept making the audience laugh in his role, but like accidentally,
right?
Because it's a drama, and he was like, I'm not supposed to be funny. Yeah. And somehow that led to Mel Brooks seeing him and considering him for this role because he is funny. Something like that. I'm sure someone will tell us the actual story.
But it's so true because he is so deadpan and fantastic, and Young Frankenstein as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're almost a little match made in heaven.
Yeah,
because to kind of deliver Mel Brooks's work, you need to take it seriously and kind of fight through any of the obvious comedy.
Yeah, well, and how interesting that they are both stage and maybe musical actors. Like, part of me really wants an alternate universe where there's a musical version of this with Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder. Like,
I know. Can you imagine?
And it's like we get real close with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, and, you know, they give those characters different dimension and depth than their predecessors. But man, that would be pretty, like, that's what I want my time travel machine to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's have another nice natural seg.
Yeah, that was good. I like, they're really natural usually when you say, like, let's segue here.
Let's have a nice natural seg.
adds to the naturalism.
The naturality.
CJ, we can do it.
Well, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Nathan Lane, because the man's a genius.
I rewatched it again today. I, you know, of course I watch clips of old Tony's telecasts because that's my life.
Yeah.
One of my favorite ones. So they had the year they won all the Tonys, they had Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick host the Tonys.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. Yeah. But the award for best actor was going to be given right after they performed their number from the producers, which was Little Old Ladyland. Yeah. And usually, after you perform your number, you put your tux back on and you go sit down. But if there's no time, you have to stand backstage in your costume. And so Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane in costume backstage, both nominated. And they're like going through and reading it. And it's Dame Edna who's giving the award.
Fascinating.
Which, like, making jokes about the Bush family and, like, really quaint political jokes, too. And I'm like, oh, what if, like, she's like, oh, we need to give the Bush family an atlas because we don't know if they know where Europe is. And I'm like, oh, what a nice, lighthearted political joke. Man, those were the days. But then they cut to Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick backstage, who are like, both nominated, and, you know, I would never know how to react in those shots they go to you, like, before get the award. And, like, especially they've been sweeping all night, so chances are one of them is going to get it. Uh-huh. And they've been hosting all night, and they're so close, and they're standing next to each other.
Yeah.
And Nathan Lane gets the award, and he grabs Matthew Broderick and drags him out on stage, like, much against his will. And, like, Matthew Broderick keeps trying to get away. And Nathan Lane is like, no, come on stage with me, and is very graciously like, I must accept this award on behalf of both of us. I am nothing without Matthew.
Yeah.
You know, it is a joy and a pleasure to work with him. And then he hands him the Tony Award, and he says, and if you're nice, we'll go out for ice cream later. And it is like, and then this is the Tony speech to watch, people. He thanks everyone by memory from the heart, and like can name everyone out, and like, and has a really nice dedication for his mom. It is, I'm turning into man in chair as the days go by. He said, thank you. Take a drink. Yeah.
If he can get through all of that, whatever 6 minutes, whatever it is.
Anyway, Nathan Lane is a treasure and a gift to society.
He really, really is. But what I think is so odd is, why isn't he like the biggest actor ever?
I think it really seems he likes what he does, and he does what he likes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, have you watched the bloopers of the movie version of The Producers?
Yeah.
Highly recommended if you're ever feeling sad and down. And like, the show is hilarious and really difficult to record on a quiet set, I imagine, where like the 100-person crew has to sit there and not laugh at the funny jokes. And they have quite the time of it trying to record some of these things. And to watch Nathan Lane like crack up and lose his lines and ad lib and just have so much fun.
Yeah.
Like it's a beautiful thing. I wish I could love something as much as Nathan Lane loves acting.
Because obviously he does a lot of theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so he's in Angels in America at the moment over here, which is, I'm in a long bit of depression because I won't see it. But so I wonder if it's just maybe you're right. Maybe he just does what he wants to do. Maybe he's like noble.
Yeah. And I mean, he's had plenty of screen roles. I mean, you know, talk about The Birdcage, talk about the other movies he's been in.
That's the point, is he's done The Birdcage.
Yeah.
He had a bit part in Goldmember.
Yeah. And I mean,
where
he's in plenty
Beyonce's of Beyonce's mouth. Like,
he's in plenty of TV shows, oftentimes as himself.
Mm. And that's it. Like, he's a treasure. He's like a national treasure.
Sorry, yeah,
I've got a bubble in my throat. He's a national treasure. But I'm just surprised because, like, I just feel, you know, you need a strong comic actor.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel you can look no further.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. No, but I don't know. I guess he hasn't done
exactly
too many movies.
It's so because the thing is, The Birdcage is amazing.
Yeah. I think he's just a stage actor. There's also something about it, and I think maybe if later we talk about the new movie musical adaptation and some of the flaws it ran into, the problems it ran into.
Yeah.
He, you know, is so larger than life. Like, Nathan Lane needs a house of 1,000 to, you know, make him really work. Like, certainly he does wonderful screen stuff. But he's got so much more energy than that and so much more dynamic than that.
Yeah.
That it seems almost confining to put him on a screen unless it's in a ridiculously larger than life role, in which case, you know, something like The Birdcage or a lot of his other appearances make perfect sense.
Beyonce's mouth. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's true, actually. I'd never really thought of that. Maybe he just doesn't... Not that it's an inability. It's just that, you know, you don't put a stopper on greatness.
Yeah.
Right?
Nathan Lane, you don't put a stopper on greatness.
That's it. You can have that for free, Nathan. I don't mind.
And it's easy to, you know, people pish-posh comedy, and you shouldn't when it comes to Nathan Lane. But talk about, like, he's committed to these roles. Infamously, he shaved part of the middle of his head for the role of Max Bialystock to make it look like he had thinning hair.
Yeah.
Like, there's, you know, he goes for it, man.
It's commitment, biatch. So, yeah, we mentioned a wee bit earlier there about the ad-libs.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that was the source of the quiz question. So it seems like they're just, it happened every other night.
Yeah.
I found like a thread.
Oh, yeah. There's like a million World. Of them. Yeah.
And, oh, cracking open another one, eh?
Hey, I don't know what you're talking about.
Tony's night, eh?
It's Tony's night. We're double dipping today. We're on a tight schedule.
Oi, oi. What is that?
That's a true blonde ale from Ska Brewing.
Ska?
Yeah.
Ska. So I found, just a list of thread of people basically saying what happened on their night of the producers. Mm-hmm. And literally just relentless. Yeah. Absolutely relentless.
And so, like, the other one we mentioned that became part of the movie and a part of the show was on the rooftop set, Franz Liebkin's pigeon rooftop. They were exiting at the end of the scene, and the door got stuck when Nathan Lane went to open it. And he ad-libbed some line that was like, trapped like rats on a roof with a madman! And then, like, got it open and was like, we're good. But it was so funny that he just kept it.
Exactly. And it seems like, so most of the people have said, and I've even read it, there's a great book called A Year with the Producers.
Uh-huh.
And it's got a couple of anecdotes in it. And one of them is about the line when he's going through the cardinal rules about being a Broadway producer. Uh-huh. And obviously, don't put your own money into the show. And then don't put your own money. And apparently, like, just most nights, you could never get through that line because of Matthew's face of just being like, uh-huh.
Oh, it's so funny.
There's this one night where he, like, tried to get through it, like, three times. So this night as well, like, the audience were kind of dead, which I don't understand, but hey, it happens.
Yeah.
And so we're sort of like, you know, they kind of reached this level of expectation where it was, oh, it's the producers. This is really funny. So they were just kind of waiting for it.
Uh-huh.
And so this was happening. And then he tried to get through it. And then just started like doing a back and forth with Matthew Broderick. I don't know how long this must have been going on for. But then obviously the audience were starting to kind of get into it.
Right.
And then... he basically walked over to where behind the couch was, laid down, was like, I'm just going to take a nap, then made a comment about Mariah Carey because she had just been in the news that day or something and the audience were going crazy. Then he got back up, finished the line, and then opened the window and pretended to jump out of it. And then came back, like, crawled round as if he'd crawled from the whole thing, came back on. It was like, it's okay. It was only one floor down. And it's just like, what the hell? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But, that is Nathan Lane. That is his comedy. It's like, take that risk and then multiply it times 100.
Absolutely. Because the thing is, so this is it, about ad-libbing. Mm-hmm. You can only do it if you're a master of it.
Yeah, and if you're, like, ridiculously confident.
Yeah, uh-huh. And it's like, because that is, he almost needs that. He's like a Jim Carrey kind of vibe. He needs that to kind of, it's almost like to diffuse himself.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? I imagine him, what's that? Marvel superhero. No, not Marvel superhero. Nathan Petrelli in Heroes, that's who it is. When he's like the bomb and he needs to just like let it all out. I feel like he's like that.
Yeah.
But then you see, I've seen it so much now. And not even amateur shows, professional shows, mostly tours, where they'll kind of fling in these ad libs that are so cheap, yeah. so unwarranted.
Yeah.
And just, oh, they just make my skin crawl.
No, you gotta earn that ad lib. Like,
you really, really do. But did you know that there's this new trend going around where they're writing in ad libs
into the producers?
No, into any production. So, for example, there's one in Hairspray. Very different. In Hairspray.
The sequel to Hairspray.
Yes, it is. And it's in Your Timeless to Me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the Michael Ball production.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd written in that they would just kind of like break out in laughing, even if that wasn't what was happening. They just corpse, and it's like, that's then not corpsing, it's just
right.
I don't know, it's just weird. It's a strange trend that's happening more and more, because obviously people know, especially in this kind of YouTube generation that we live in, where people gunning for this special moment, this was so funny,
because and you like, do feel the night I got to see the show, the this thing happened.
Exactly, so you do feel kind of special, because like, oh my god, they broke out a character, it was so good, you had to be there, kind of thing,
right?
Like SNL vibe, and it's, but now people like cashing in on that, and it just
feels a little
exactly, and
a
you
little
forget
slimy.
That there's an almost an art form to it.
Right. Oh, there's absolutely an art form to it. Your ad lib needs to be, you know, at least five times as funny as the lines in the show. So unless you trust yourself with that, don't you dare.
Exactly. Let that be a warning to you all.
Yeah. We'll come and find you. We will. Jimmy and I will stand up in the back and walk out of your show.
with maybe like a little mini stomp in there. Like, I'll wear heels.
Yeah, good. I'll wear a giant fruity hat to block the people behind me.
Yeah. Ha ha ha. So there you go. Before we move away from the actors, though, I do want to say, especially in this day and age, if you never saw it when it came around the first time, from Jimmy Kimmel, I think.
Oh, Fallon, yeah. One of the late night hosts.
Yeah. They did a sketch called Trumped. And it was the great reunion of Leo Bloom and Max Bialystock.
It's from a simpler time when
I know. How was that from a simpler time?
No, and it totally was.
Oh my gosh.
Oh man! But if you need some good nostalgia about how life used to be before the president,
everything,
of the United States,
just everything. Have you heard about British politics? You probably haven't heard much about it.
I've heard bits and pieces, and like, I understand maybe half of it, but it sounds crazy sauce.
I'll give you an explanation later. It's a joy. So yeah, go have some fun with Max and Leo. And I guess we should say Matthew Broderick's also great, but he's just different.
Matthew Broderick is hilarious in this role. I think I have loved Matthew Broderick since Ferris Bueller's Day Off, you know.
Absolutely. Election. Have you ever seen Election?
I've not seen Election.
Oh my good grief. It's Matthew Broderick and a baby Reese Witherspoon. Not a baby, but like a young Reese Witherspoon.
A two-year-old Reese Witherspoon.
2 years old. It's incredible. It's so funny.
Really?
It's about a high school election.
Really? I mean, what's interesting, when the producers came out, Matthew Broderick was on the tail end of a couple flop movies. Especially The American Godzilla.
Oh my god.
Right.
Oh my god, I forgot he was in that.
Right, which was awful.
Yeah.
And then hit it big with this. And this was maybe his musical theater debut.
But either way, well done, Matthew. We love you too.
Yeah, his eyes are hilarious.
His face is great. The thing is, it's like to fill Gene Wilder's shoes.
Yeah.
I would be terrified.
Oh, absolutely. But the control Matthew Broderick has over his face is stunning.
Yep.
Like
absolutely.
You could watch, especially the movie musical, you watch the whole thing through, spend the whole time watching Matthew Broderick in the background.
Yeah, exactly.
Anytime something hilarious or weird happens, he's like, oh, what?
Yeah.
Oh?
Well, Gene Hackman often said that Leo Bloom is kind of like the audience. And he doesn't have many lines, and he's mostly just there to react to all of the nonsense that's going around.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's 100%.
That's true. I never thought about it that way, but that is a brilliant description.
Yeah, there's a really great documentary attached to it's like basically the making of the movie. Mm-hmm. We'll link it in the show notes. These will be a good show notes this week. So yeah, we'll link that in there. But yeah, really, really good. Well done, guys. Well done, lads.
Yes.
Do more. Do more together. Please. I don't know what.
They did do It's Only a Play.
Right, okay.
Which I know nothing about. But I know they're in it. And I'm sure they're in it because people like them together.
Yeah, they're just cute. It's like you could ship them. It'd be weird.
Is that It's Only a Play on Broadway right now? Starring Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick?
No, because Nathan Lane's over here.
2014.
This is 2017.
I was never very good at math.
That's okay. Welcome to this year. It's not going very well.
And now it's springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and caring. We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Rhineland's a fine land once more. Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Watch out, Europe, we're going on tour. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Look, it's springtime.
Winter.
This is a musical that is difficult to post pictures on Facebook of.
Yeah, you wouldn't cosplay the producers.
Right? There's I think of this because there was a when Title of Show was on and like doing all of its Title of Show internety things. Mm-hmm. They had a bunch of like fan submission video stuff. And one of them, I think, was nine people's favorite things and like hold up a sign that says something, something on it or whatever. And of course, a bunch of musical theater people sent in photos of them with their community theater productions, like doing the whatever thing, including like a whole group of people dressed up as Nazis sending in the whatever thing. And it had like a big caption underneath that was like, from a musical production of the producers. That was, you know, it was like, not Nazis. They're not Nazis. Yeah, this like, so there's, it is a taboo. There are taboo subjects discussed in this musical that only make sense in the context of the whole show.
Yeah.
And even then are cause for some controversy.
I know. So, yeah, I mean, again, we kind of need to call back to the film, the original film, because it was it was panned. It was really, really panned because people just say this is completely tasteless.
Yeah.
You can't do this. And I wonder if that's why you think it's a cult classic, is because it's not like...
It didn't do well at the beginning.
Like beloved, do you know what I mean? But and it was still, that's the thing, is it was still thoroughly enjoyed by audiences and everyone were rating it so highly, but the critics were just like, no, you can't do this, basically. Which is very, very interesting. And then so, but I feel the interesting point comes from with the musical, nobody batted an eyelid.
I wonder, I mean, it seems like such... The simple explanation of the cure of time.
Yeah.
The difference between 1968 and 2001.
Yeah.
And like how more global we are as a society. And I think, you know, we talk, I think the bar for censorship and taboo-ness goes down a couple inches every decade or so. Certainly it fluctuates in the short term, but I think in the long term, you know, you can say more and more things on television. The, you know, Lucy and Ricky had to sleep in separate beds, but the Bradys could sleep in the same bed. Like, you see these things, you know, trickle down. And I think by 2001, I don't know, maybe we're more able to laugh at these things and like poke fun and like satirize this.
I feel like, I mean, I'm trying to think, but I do feel like Producers was probably one of the first times that kind of happened and really probably started paving the way for your Spring Awakenings, for your Avenue Q's, for your Book of Mormons's.
Well, and especially those last two, which absolutely capitalize on the musical theater form to get their satire across.
Exactly. Exactamundo. So, yeah, I feel that, in many ways that it paved the way, but I think in many ways it did it so correctly.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I think this all comes down to Mel Brooks. There's a great, just needs to jump in right here, there's a great documentary YouTube video, like a YouTube video essay, I guess.
Yeah.
From a gal called Shay Lindsay. She does these amazing YouTube essays, like I say, about different movies and topics in cinema. She's really, really great. I recommend them all. She does one on Rent as well. And basically she goes into a lot about the kind of ethics of satire about the Nazis specifically.
Yes.
And how Mel Brooks fits into that. And she talks a lot about Blazing Saddles as well. But just how he... And it's not because he's Jewish and kind of unashamedly Jewish, not that you should be ashamed to be Jewish, but is very, you know, outspokenly Jewish, I should say. And it isn't because that. He's not saying, I'm Jewish, so therefore I can make these jokes.
Right.
He just looks at it from the point of view of why we need satire in a society.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that it's important to kind of laugh at these things because if you don't, it's giving it power, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like a boggart.
It is like a boggart. You have to change it into something funny to get rid of it. It is. I do think the Producers treads a really fine line because we go from a ridiculous satire of a neo-Nazi on a roof where he trains pigeons, including one named Adolf, that is like absolutely ridiculous and we're supposed to laugh at and find absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
To a scathing satire of a gay director, which, you know, on the compendium of morality and things we like in our world and things we don't like in our world, we don't like neo-Nazis, but we do like gay people. And I think Mel Brooks gets away with it, but it is putting all these things in the same show is dangerous. And he's setting himself up because the reason the satire of the Nazis works out is because this super flamboyant gay man plays Hitler, which is like, and then you feel the satire because you know homosexuals were prosecuted by the, you know, by the Nazis, and persecuted by the Nazis. And so then it's like insult to injury, that which is how Franz Liebkin then reacts, is like, you have dishonored the memory of Adolf Hitler, and you're like, good, F you. Like, that's why
and
he gets
why
away
Springtime
with
for Hitler was such a success.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Because that would work. And I guess like Springtime for Hitler and Book of Mormon aren't a gazillion miles away from each other.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's why it works, is because you are laughing at the things. I don't have a point to make this. I'm just gonna stop that at the Mormon one.
I do, on this topic, one of the most interesting things, and I've known about this for a while, but I did a bunch more research on it for this. The first production of The Producers that premiered in Germany, premiered in Berlin in 2009. I don't know a lot about German theater, but at least according to the research I've done, the production premiered in an old theater that had a box specifically built for Hitler. And like had been torn down maybe a couple years prior, but still there was a lot of trepidation and nervousness about this. Like, you're not allowed to show the swastika in Germany. And it's props in the show. Like, and you know, there were definitely mixed opinions before it premiered on like, can we do this? Are we okay, like, mm-hmm. laughing at this and, you know, making a joke out of something that is pretty serious, especially mm-hmm. to, you know, German culture?
Well, so tied into their history, more so yeah. than anywhere else.
Yeah. And, you know, from it's hard to find a lot of reviews and talk about this, but from what I heard, the vast majority of people thought it was really funny.
Yeah.
There was a lot of, like, they were not allowed to use the swastika in any advertisements, so they just replaced it with a pretzel. Like, literally, they had big flags outside of the theater that look exactly like Nazi flags, but instead of a swastika, it's a black pretzel.
Excellent.
Which is like, what? But then they did use actual swastikas in the show.
Okay.
Including the armbands at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And according to one of the reviews, that was a moment where the audience was like, oh, because, like, seeing this symbol that is illegal in your country and, like, you know, has all this connotation and weight associated with it in a very funny context, maybe.
Yeah.
I could see how that's like, oh, God, are we allowed to laugh at this?
Yeah.
Can we find this funny?
Yeah.
Or is this just going to be in really poor taste?
Yep.
So it's fascinating to me. Mm.
No, definitely. Yeah. And the thing is, as well, I think it's important to note, like, the Germans love their musical theater.
Mm-hmm.
It's so... Musical theater is huge in Germany.
Yeah.
And so I can imagine them, obviously, you know, seeing how popular The Producers was,
mm-hmm.
it'd be very important to them to get a production of it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Because it's good musical theater.
Exactly. Absolutely. And I guess theater's the place that we get away with stuff like this. That's the place that we can have these conversations.
Yeah.
In whatever kind of guise they take.
Yeah.
But
I wonder, you know, we live in strange and interesting times. I mean, it's worth noting, yesterday, 2017, in June, in Denver, Colorado, there was a neo-Nazi rally 2 blocks from where I live right now.
Yeah.
And, like, that's...
I know.
You know. Things there's some hate coming back out. There's some of the thing this is satirizing coming back out.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I would wonder when we're gonna feel okay. Like, we are in political turmoil right now in mm-hmm. a bunch of different ways across the country. I wonder what the timeline is on that. When are we gonna feel okay absolutely satirizing this again, and not in the SNL way where you, like, laugh and cry at the same time because you're like,
yeah.
Oh God, yeah, it is awful. But when, you know, we'll be far enough past it again.
Yeah. Nope, it's a good question. I don't have the answer, I'm afraid. I don't think that's one for Reddit. I don't think they'll have the answer either. So I mean, yeah, because it's obviously we hit on these musicals every now and then, tell me where we'll, you know, love them or maybe not love them as much, but, you know, hit into the fact that they might not be necessarily, you know, doing it the right way.
Yeah.
But I feel like I can't say that about The Producers at all.
I feel like I can't say that about The Producers in 2001. I could see a future where maybe there's parts of the satire of The Producers that is a little too close to home.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, there's, which, like, it makes me deeply, darkly sad on the inside. But, you know, 2001 was a different time from 2017.
It definitely was, but 1969 was a different time to 2001.
That's point taken.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was a lot closer to the actual event.
Yeah. I think that is, of course, at its core, the argument over the nature of this show. Like,
yeah.
is the satire satirical enough that it's okay? Or mm-hmm. is it so close to the source that you're actually reinforcing the thing you're attempting to satirize?
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone leaves The Producers going like, aha, yes, and now I will become a Nazi. Like, I can't imagine. If you're that audience member, you vastly misunderstood the show.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's just something wrong with your brain chemistry there.
Right,
brain.
Exactly. But, you know, it is... It's also... I do think it helps that it is not actually a show about Nazis.
Yeah, exactly. No,
you know,
completely.
Like, it's not, like
it features, sure. But
featuring Nazis!
Yeah, I know. But, like, you know, it also features old ladies and,
right.
And transvestite men.
Yeah,
like,
right. Like, it's super caricatures of everything.
Exactly.
And, yeah, it's...
Yeah, it's as much a show about pigeons as it is about... Nazis,
that's a great
ways.
Comparison. It's as much a show about pigeons as it is about Nazis. Mm-hmm. And both are equally comical, and so you can only take one as seriously as you take the other.
Exactly. And those pigeons are great.
Ah, I'm the little pigeon.
Drama's so depressed, it's hard to sell a ticket on Broadway. Shows should be more pretty, shows should be more witty. Show should be more, what's the word? Gay? Exactly. No matter what you do on the stage, keep it light, keep it bright, keep it gay. Whether it's murder, mayhem, or rage, don't complain, it's a pain, keep it gay.
People want laughter when they see a show. The last thing they're after's a litany of woe.
A happy ending will pep up your play. Oedipus won't bomb
if he winds up with mom.
Keep it gay.
Keep it gay.
Keep it gay.
So I find, Tommy, every time we talk about a musical, we barely talk about the musical.
I do think The Producers, especially, is a great musical to study the kind of... I don't know, plot structure and tropes of musical theater, because
yes.
It's very, this musical's great, but as far as the structure is concerned, it's very surface level. There is no B plot. This is just an A plot musical. We never, like, it's never like, meanwhile, back on the farm, and like, you go to the other place. It has really clear cut I want songs. It has really clear cut, like, exposition songs. It's like, it's good to study it for that reason.
Yeah,
it's certainly
totally.
Not the best example of it because of that, because it's so simplistic and doesn't take advantage or bend the form in a lot of ways. But it does, you know, it makes it easier to study. It's like reading Dr. Seuss when you're learning how to read.
Yeah. But I mean, it's one of those, still so many people use the monomyth. Like,
oh yeah.
It's everywhere still. And I feel like in many ways, like, The Producer is just a good masterclass on it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's with the, oh, what's the one in the monomyth structure where it's like you're the baddie comes in and tests allies and enemies.
Mm-hmm.
So other examples in other musicals would be in, for example, like Little Shop of Horrors. The dentist comes in and pulls Seymour away. It doesn't fit that. But yeah, basically that's it. But I think it's interesting in here that they kind of team up a love story.
Yeah.
With this, like, idea of like,
it's what makes
it's not
the villain.
Not...
Yeah.
Yeah, like, there's not a baddie.
Yeah, it allows the antagonist to be sympathetic.
Exactly.
Leo Bloom, who becomes the antagonist in, Act 2, you still, then his return and transition back from the antagonist to co-protagonist is what lets you be like, oh, and makes it a super, super happy story.
Exactly.
And they do it so surface level. You think of the first song, like, it's opening night, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's Max Bialystock's latest show. Will it flop or will it go? You now know everything you need to know about the exposition for what's about to happen. Two lines down, boom! It's a show. We don't know if it's going to do well. Questions in your mind. Also, Max Bialystock. Who could he be? Probably the protagonist. There's nothing, you know, we're not hiding it here.
Exactly.
It's not even like Good Morning Baltimore, where it's like there's still some, you know, you're
yeah,
you're
we're gonna build you up, we're gonna build up your story here,
right? Or even it's still not even like the prologue to Into the Woods, where it's like, once upon a time there was this and that and this. Like, there is no pretext in the exposition of this show. You know, no. It's opening night. Will Max's show do well? It doesn't. I used to be the king of Broadway. Here's what I want. I want to be the king of Broadway again. Like, yeah. We got all your backstory, the setting you live in, and what you want. And then Stranger Comes to Town, Leo Bloom shows up, and he's what sets the story in motion. Like,
yeah, exactly.
And on and on and on, and then this happens, and then that happens, yeah. And it's, like,
it
super easy to unpack.
They decide about the musical. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. But I do think that's so good, though.
Yeah, it's worth
because,
it.
Because, yeah, there are moments like... I think so. I always use Star Wars as a really good example because
it's a great plot structure example.
Yeah, it's so clear cut.
Yeah.
And I find it because like when I've been doing like writing practice and things like that and trying to like write something in that structure but without making it seem contrived.
Yeah, it's hard to do.
It's so difficult.
Yeah, and that's the thing is like simple plot is harder to do than complex plot.
Exactly.
I think I've been seeing bouncing around the internet and I have not good feelings about it, but there's a maybe fan-made movie coming out in the Harry Potter universe.
Oh my god, what the hell is this?
I know, you've seen this, The Origins of the Air, it's like where Voldemort came from, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, but surely that's just like the same as the Legends of Zelda trailer.
Right. I wonder if they're going to get their pantsuit off of them. But I got like halfway through the trailer and they were like, I am so-and-so, such-and-such, betrothed to you by blah, 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 and this and this and this, and here's another plot point. And like, no, 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 no. It simple. Give me like two things, maybe.
Exactly. Have
and then
one person
decorate the rest of your world. Like,
yeah,
you know, and that's what lets the producers be so successful is their plot is so straightforward and simple is then they get to make these ridiculous jokes and other things all around it.
Exactly.
I do think
exactly.
One of the big questions of the producers that I always have as far as plot structure is concerned, the Act One closer, which I think is a really interesting Act One closer in my mind because
yeah.
We like totally forego any concept that like this is real and everyone just comes out and reprises a thing they sang about like how excited they're about the next thing that's gonna happen.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you know, it's like a massive multiplayer number set in limbo.
Yeah.
Which you don't see a lot of Act One closers that way. You see a lot of finales that way, but not a lot of Act One closers that way.
Yep.
And in that moment at the end of Act One, when Leo and Max shake hands and they say, we can't miss, I'm spoiled because I know the ending. I wonder uh-huh. how someone who goes into this not knowing the ending feels about that. Like, the comedy of the show is like all their expectations are reversed.
Exactly.
And I wonder, I don't know which is the better choice for an audience member either. Like, do you telegraph that it's totally going to be successful? Or do you let it be a giant surprise? And I think there are benefits to each.
But I don't know, because I think it wouldn't be good if Springtime for Hitler was bad and it bombed.
Yeah.
The show would be crap. Do you know what I mean? It would be really awful because they'd
right,
just leave
exactly.
with their money.
Yeah,
and that would be that. And you're like, oh, okay,
right?
But you know, I mean, you have to see how are you going to get out of this one, Max?
Right?
Do you know what I mean? Like, ha ha ha, the joke's on you. And you do like, you know, from opening night, from that first number,
yeah.
When they say it's the worst show, and you're expecting them to
you're
say it's the best show in town, and
but also
they don't.
But
they
think
flip
there's
it on the head.
There's like, you know, the number of times it's that reoccurring line when is like Leo's like, are we in too deep yet? And Max is like, I'll let you. This is nothing. I'll let you know when we're in too deep. I'll let you know when we're in too deep. And then when Franz comes in with the gun, he's like, hey, we're in too deep.
Too deep. Too deep.
And like, you know, that's foreshadowing. That's like, I'll let you know when we're in too deep. That's Chekhov's gun. That's like, literally the gun's going to go off in Act Two.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's fascinating to me. Like, that's one of the big questions I have about the structure of this, and you know, it's a question with no answer. That's the wonderful thing about literary analysis. It's not about finding answers, it's about asking questions.
Yeah, exactly. I do also, I just want to shout out to the actual music.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about this, and I was listening to it sort of analytically, which I'd never really done before.
Mm-hmm.
It's really smart.
It's really
smart.
It's really solid.
Up, Yeah, it just taps into that golden age sound. Mm-hmm. And they do, so they do this thing. It's there probably is a technical term for it. Mm-hmm. You might know it. So, you know, for example, you take something like Luck Be a Lady,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Where, you know, it starts off with, they call you Lady Luck, but then
it's got the intro, yeah.
Right, and then it goes into na na na. All I do is pray. Da-da-da-da-da, luck be a late, and that's kind of where the song starts.
Yeah,
so that is like a golden age trope that happens all the way through. Mm-hmm. Every you know, in every Rodgers and Hammerstein that features at least four times.
Yes,
and it happens in the producers.
Yeah.
So
the urge
like,
to merge can rob us of our senses.
Absolutely.
We can make a man a drone. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And Along Came Bialy as well, even though it's a chorus number, it still is the same thing.
Yep.
It's really, really interesting. And I think it's a total choice by Mel Brooks because it's now set in the Golden Age, and it completely harks back to that vibe. Do you know what I mean?
Well, and it's also, it's really interesting to me that it, because it takes that, but it does not take the, like, chorus-verse-chorus structure, except for maybe We Can Do It, which only does it because it's a duet, so that they can go back and sing We Can Do It a couple times.
I don't know, but that face is very much a chorus-verse-chorus.
Yeah, no, I think it's worth it. It's a good melding, it's a good golden age musical pastiche with the expectations we have of a 2001 piece of musical theater.
Exactly. Like
you're doing the things that remind us of that, but you don't need us to remember the chorus when we leave because we're not going to buy a record.
And even that, you know, the kind of long drawn out musical number that they always have in Act Two.
Yeah,
Springtime for Hitler. It's right there for you.
You know,
I will
say one of the wonderful things about this show. This is one of the few shows I can think of off the top of my head that does not fall into the Act Two slump. There is nothing boring or attempting to pick up the story in Act Two. You are excited from the moment Act Two starts until the finale.
For sure.
There's not like, we don't need to introduce, like, I guess we introduce additional complications in Franz breaking his leg. But that doesn't seem manufactured or artificial to like increase the drama. That seems like as planned.
Cause that's the thing is it could fall flat once the show's up and running, do you know what I mean? But they still have, you know, like, oh my god, Betrayed. Like
Betrayed is a beautiful 11
It's an expert number. And then the whole prison scene, like, it's huge, the second act.
It's great.
So
and
good.
It just keeps running. It's wonderful. And then, and it's still not afraid to make fun of itself. Like,
completely.
All, you know, Ulla Payne, they have a whole second set for one joke. They have a whole replica set painted white for a stupid joke. When did you
literally,
do this?
Yeah, literally.
Intermission. Like, that's it. And is so funny and ridiculous and bizarre. Like, I love stuff like that.
Yeah, it's really, really smart. And I just find that, like, you got to throw your hat off to Mel Brooks. Like, obviously, you wouldn't think, oh, Mel Brooks a staple of the musical theater.
Right.
And it's almost a pity because, like, Young Frankenstein as well is really, really good fun. I'd say Producers is kind of masterful.
Yeah.
But no, I really like Young Frankenstein. I think it's funny.
You're allowed to like Young Frankenstein.
Thank you. In the same way you're not allowed to like Miss Saigon. But yeah, like, he's a talented bugger.
Yeah, he definitely
is. And I also didn't
is.
Know he performed.
Yeah, kind of.
He performs, in History of whatever it's called. The History of...
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, he's in a bunch of his own movies. He's in Silent Movie.
Yeah,
in
History of the World, that's it.
Yeah, he is, and he has cameos in a bunch of them, too. He has a cameo in the stage musical. The line, "Don't be stupid, be a smarty, come and join the Nazi party." Is pre-recorded
is
Mel Brooks saying that line. It's not him on
there
stage.
There you go.
You know, he's got better things to do.
But he's really good.
Yeah.
In History of the World, he's fantastic. I'm like, you're a great little man.
Oh, he's very funny. You would love, he has a movie called Silent Movie.
I've seen it.
Oh, I love Silent Movie.
It's so good. Yeah. It's just, No, like, I'm a massive Mel Brooks fan. And Yeah, just your hat goes off to him, and it's, I wish he'd write more musicals.
I know, it's fascinating to see him slide into the world of musical theater so effortlessly.
I know. It'd be interesting. I wonder what he would do with an original. Do you know what I mean? Because obviously, Young Frankenstein producers are both adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
What would he do with a story written specifically for the musical theater stage?
Yeah, that's
I don't know.
True.
I think he'd do it well, mate.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe he will.
Next year, Broadway's changing. Mel Brooks might be the next great comet.
I hear him and Dave Malloy have got an ace up their sleeve.
I would love to see like a dinner conversation between Dave Malloy and Mel Brooks. I would love nothing more.
I can't even picture that in any way, shape, or form. It'd be interesting.
It'd be wonderful to be a fly on the wall in that room.
That was the producers.
Wasn't that fun? It's such a fun show.
I know. Every time we do like a biggin, I'm always like, aw. I feel like it's our little peg in the shale.
Yeah. The producers.
That's
not
a phrase.
Peg in the shale.
Peg
I would have
shale.
Believed you. That sounds like a Scottishism.
Well, it could work. It makes sense. It's a peg in the shale.
Peg in the shale sounds like a poor lady who's trapped inside of a pool table.
Shale. Yeah,
I guess
sure.
That's made of slate and not shale. I don't know.
One more peg in the shale. Anyway, but before we leave the producers, I do want to ask, you've written the words.
Uh-huh.
Is this a Google whack? Tommy's gay bar Hitler.
This is a real thing. So you know about the most wonderful place in the world, the gay bar in Chicago that plays musical theater on Mondays.
Music Mondays.
There is a reoccurring bar patron there who me and my friends refer to him as Hitler.
Okay.
Because every musical Mondays, they play Springtime for Hitler, and he goes and stands up in one of the corners, and all the bar lights shine on him, and everyone points their phone lights at him, and he lip syncs and reenacts the entire number of Springtime for Hitler, and it is one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen. He's got a comb that he holds up as a mustache. He marches, he ducks, we all wave our lights around like it's ballyhoo. When it goes bombs falling from the skies again, whew, boom, everyone throws their napkins in the air so they rain down. And sometimes Hitler is sick or isn't at the bar on Monday nights, and they'll put the thing on and no one will show up, and everyone will be like, where is Hitler? We're so sad Hitler isn't here today. What? And it's like one of those conversations that in any other context would be ridiculously indecipherable. But I think it is one of the most beautiful things in the world. Like, do you know how we need to remember Adolf Hitler? As a gay man making fun of him in a gay bar in a gay neighborhood in a progressive society.
Yeah.
This is the way to honor the spirit and the memory of Adolf Elizabeth Hitler.
This bar is so strange.
Oh, it's so much fun.
It's just like with the Titanic, with the Tonys, with the Liza Arms, this. Like,
I haven't even told
you
about what happens during Wicked or the Poseidon Adventure.
It is like
nothing else. Or Evita. Let's talk about Evita.
No. Well, we will when we do Evita. Don't
one of these times. I won't spoil it now. But I can never listen to Don't Cry For Me Argentina the same way again.
Fascinating.
Yeah. It's a magical place.
Do you think they'd sponsor us or something?
I think they're doing just fine.
Okay.
I think they sponsor me well enough with, you know, vodka cranberries and time to think up stupid ideas for videos.
Hear, hear. Yeah, we should go there though. We should do like a viewing.
We absolutely should. We should go just you and me because it's fun.
Well, that too, but yeah, what a place. I just can't imagine it. I think it'd be one of those things I'd do And I'd go and I'd be like, I'd probably be so overwhelmed.
Absolutely. Most people are. It's always fun whenever these things happen to like spot the people in the crowd who this is their first time there.
Yeah.
And they're like, what?
Because like that's my favorite thing. If you ever do a Rocky Horror,
mm-hmm.
do you know what I mean? Like yeah. in Spotting the Virgins.
Yep.
And
it's like a very specific musical theater Rocky Horror.
Definitely.
Every week.
But I'd probably get quite sad or probably really angry because, you know, I know some things about musical theater, and I'd go there and I'd probably feel like an idiot.
Well, that's why.
Because it's like, it's above. I wouldn't know to throw my napkin in the air, you know?
No, well, the crazy thing is, like, I know plenty about musical theater and plenty about this bar, and every once in a while, something will come on the TV, and my friends will turn to me, and they'll be like, what is this? And they'll be like, I don't know. And it'll be like Bob Fosse tap dancing or something.
I could do that.
And I'll be like, I have never, ever, or like some weird Judy Garland performance that you've never seen before.
That too.
We need you.
Oh my God. Have you ever seen Barbra Streisand?
And Judy Garland.
She did her A Kid Again, that era.
I don't think so.
Oh my God, that's a treat. We'll save that. That will come up in a podcast at some point.
But you have seen Barbra Streisand and Judy Garland doing their happy duet, right?
Of
with
course.
The arrows. There's a callback to that. It's something like, guess which one of us is drunk? Follow the arrows! And they're all pointing at Judy Garland.
Excellent. Oh, Judy.
We've got a quiz question for you. You ready? No,
yeah.
I can come back to you. Raise your hand again, and when I come back around the room.
Oh my God, that just gave me weird, horrible flashbacks. Yes, give me an eye.
One of Tommy's favorite numbers from next week's musical was actually parodied in an episode of Glee. Although they do not sing a song from the actual musical, the circumstances and the setting during this funny girl era of season 5 of Glee are a direct mirror of the circumstances and setting of this number from next week's musical.
Interesting.
Complex.
That means it's time for a Glee wind. Glee. We're doing Glee. It's a Glee podcast about Glee.
If we ever start a Glee podcast, it's going to be called It's a Glee Podcast About Glee.
Can it just be me talking at you about Glee and you just going...
And then can it be me be going like... Doom, dump, ba, da, doom, dap, da.
Yeah.
Bum, 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 ba.
Yeah, actually, that sounds like a really good idea.
Oh, God.
Gonna write it on my board. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can. You can find me over on Twitter at AsinHendrix or on YouTube at the same name.
I hear you passed a big YouTube milestone.
I did, and I've earned it. Have I?
I think you have.
Thank you very much, sir. Yeah, I reached 500 subscribers. Woo! How many are you on? You on...
That- 20,000?
You're 24,000 almost.
I don't know how this happened.
That's
if you want to
so
find
good.
Me, I'm Musical Theater Mash on YouTube and Musical Mash on Twitter, or check out our show Twitter at Jim and Tomic or our website, jimandtomic.com, which has a link to the Reddit discussion where you can talk about this episode.
Mm-hmm. No Reddit rundown this week, but, you know, that's okay. There was some great discussion. It's over there.
Yeah.
And... It would be really nice if you go and tell your friends all about this podcast.
Plenty of people have. I keep seeing, like, I keep getting tagged in recommendations between other people across the internet about podcasts, which is awesome. You're amazing people.
Absolutely. And if you listen to an episode in the Vatican City, please let us know who you are, because that is fascinating.
Jimmy's been diving into the analytics, and this is driving him crazy. The Pope.
It's
the Pope listens to our
Imagine
podcast.
Imagine if it was the Pope, though!
It wasn't the Pope.
The Pope. God, there's many Pope references in musical theater, right?
Yeah, Call from the Vatican. We could probably make a whole episode about Pope and Vatican references in musical theater.
There we go. That'll be my return to YouTube. The Pope episode.
Yeah, wait till you hear about what I have planned post-Tonys for my videos on YouTube. It'll be a surprise.
Excellent.
And with that, we'll see you next
week.
We'll
see you next winter.
Tottaloo. Tottaloo.
You said that a couple of times now. There's something wrong.
I'm trying to make it a thing.
Toodaloo.